dropped significantly in recent months.
But the European Commission acknowledges Russia has honoured all of its gas supply contracts. Moscow insists it's willing to supply more if new contracts are signed. This has already happened with Germany and Turkey, the Kremlin says.
As was stated recently in the European Parliament, perhaps the best way to ensure energy security would be for the EU to stop using Ukraine to provoke Russia. This, as Ukraine is corrupt to the core and at the highest levels, according to the European Court of Auditors, which is the EU's financial watchdog. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There's no end in sight to the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies commit yet another inhumane crime amid the deafening silence of the United Nations and other international bodies and so-called advocates of human rights. Saudi warplanes bombarded the western city of Hodeidah and a detention center in the northern city of Saada within hours. Dozens of people, including children, were reportedly killed in Saada alone. The overnight strike on Hodeidah also left several casualties, most of them children. The strikes triggered a nationwide internet blackout in the country. The Norwegian ambassador to the United Nations, whose country holds the presidency of the UN Security Council for January, has reacted to the strikes.
New attack or series of attacks is at least 60 dead, maybe as many as 100. I mean, that can't be acceptable, can it?
No, I mean, it's not acceptable, and we absolutely call for restraints on all sides.
On Friday, thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in Sana'a to denounce the latest deadly airstrikes. The protesters condemned the United States for arming and backing Riyadh and its allies in the war on Yemen. The coalition has stepped up airstrikes against Yemen in recent weeks, killing dozens of civilians, including children.
Now we have become afraid day and night and in the morning. You don't know when the strikes will happen. The homes of citizens are now military targets, and this is what we fear. You fear that you will take children to school or to the hospitals or something like that, and you will get hit.
The spike in Saudi-led aggression follows Yemen's successful operation deep inside the UAE in retaliation for its role in the Saudi-led onslaught. During the operation, several sensitive locations in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, such as airports and oil refineries, were targeted with drones and ballistic missiles. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015 in an attempt to reinstate a friendly regime there. The kingdom has also maintained a blockade on Yemen ever since it began the war, while the impoverished country is in dire need of basic supplies such as food and medicine. Years of bombing and blockade have left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions of them. The impoverished country is experiencing what the UN has described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Twice a week, help is sent out by the truckload. Donations made to this charity in West London are on their way to families hit hard by the rising cost of living. For other charities, it's an everyday job. Nearly 2.5 million people used a food bank in the UK last year. With inflation now the highest in three decades, charities are warning it's only exacerbating an already dire situation.
The striking thing is how fast prices are rising. Bread up by more than 4%, margarine 27%, eggs more than 5%, and apples up by a fifth. The same with other staples. Put them all together, and you're talking about a sharp rise in the cost of living.
And that's just food. There have also been rises in the cost of transportation, clothing, and energy. Utility bills are expected to go up by 50% in spring, affecting some more than others.
You'll notice it, but it won't affect you too much. The poorest will have been most affected by this. Those with the narrowest shoulders are taking the worst of the burden, which we need to reverse to try and make sure it's those with the broadest shoulders to take most of the weight.
Economists say the UK is facing a perfect storm of COVID, Brexit, and global supply shortages. The question now is whether the government's proposed ways of mitigating the pressure on the people are enough.
The good news is, so far, the capitalism has started to grow again. It's actually building back up. But they haven't addressed the issue of fairness, and over the next few months, this is going to be particularly painful in Britain. The cost of power, potentially doubling in the next few months, will mean that some people will go into fuel poverty almost certainly.
These are just snapshots from across the country of a resurgence of poverty, and it looks like for many in the UK, things are going to get worse before they might get better. Sai Puruza, London.
Protesters outside the Israeli embassy have called for a boycott of Israel and those who support it, the delegitimization of the Zionist regime by Britain, which gave birth to it, and an end to apartheid.
We see you! We know your complicity! And we won't let you enable the ruthless and barbaric actions of the Israeli state in our name!
Israel is finding it more and more difficult to prevent the global community from knowing what's going on in the occupied territories. No amount of algorithms can stifle the cry for justice, and more people are standing in solidarity with the Palestinians.
For decades, Israel has been chipping away at Palestinian neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Now it's set its sights on Sheikh Jarrah. In May 2021, this neighborhood became an international focal point, with residents resisting expulsion using digital activism. The diaspora was galvanized, 180,000 people took to London's streets, and the land grab was postponed as a result. Londoners say the videoing of atrocities is working, but the Israeli lobby is strong.
Mona Al-Kurd, who is from Sheikh Jarrah, as she was transmitting the demolition of the garden center of the Salha family, her Instagram was blocked. So as far as we can, Palestinians and supporters try and portray to the world what is happening there. What we need to do is to find ways of turning that into a change in government policy.
The message is getting out. I am of an age where I went first to Israel in the 60s, shortly after the Seven-Day War. People in this country did not know about Palestine. There was no understanding of the Nakba. There was no understanding of the expulsion of Palestinians. And for years and years, the Israeli government was allowed to continue, and this ignorance was perpetuated by the media.
Racism is a hot topic in the Western world, with people rising up against all forms of discrimination and inequality. And for many, Israel is synonymous with racism.
I think there are still organizations like the BBC which do not report what is going on in the ground. Therefore, tools like social media are really, really important.
They're not going to get away with it. And as Martin Luther King said, the arc of history may be long, but it bends towards justice. We will win this fight, because justice will win.
Demolitions have begun, some in the dead of night. Stun grenades were used, the power cut, and dozens arrested. The ethnic cleansing continues, as does the fight to end the last apartheid on Earth. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Russia's guided missile cruiser Varyag and its anti-submarine destroyer, the Admiral Tributes, paraded along Iranian and Chinese warships in Iran's southern territorial waters as the last phase of a joint naval maneuver codenamed Maritime Security Belt, conducted over 17,000 square kilometer area in north of the Indian Ocean. The one-day drill engaged some of the latest naval equipment of the three participating countries.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy, together with the navies of the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China, staged a joint drill with the motto of Together for Peace and Security. The ultimate goal of the exercises is to enhance the readiness of the three countries in confronting marine threats that are posed to civilian seafaring.
China's Urumqi destroyer and Iran's domestically built Dena and Jamaran destroyers were among the vessels that were deployed to the drills. The trilateral maneuvers saw the three navies practicing anti-piracy operations, where they freed two commercial ships from pirates. Iran's Navy says the drill will significantly boost the three countries' coordination and synergy in combating piracy and ensuring the safety of international shipping in the strategic Indo-Pacific region.
North of the Indian Ocean is of a special significance in terms of global trade. That's why it is associated with constant threats such as terrorism and piracy. Therefore, closer cooperation between the actors in this region promises safer maritime trade for all countries.
North of the Indian Ocean hosts more than half of the world's maritime oil trade, which passed through three strategic straits of Hormuz, Bab el-Mandeb, and Malacca, together forming what's known as the Golden Triangle of international trade. It's the third time Iran, China, and Russia are holding a joint drill in this body of water, with the aim to turn the thruway into a safe transit route for all passing ships.
Iran, Russia, and China wrapped up their joint military exercises with strong messages. On top of them is their growing naval cooperation to ensure a collective security in the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and north of the Indian Ocean. This as they advised Western actors in the region to avoid destabilizing activities. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
Iran warns that Israel is exploiting the United Nations mechanisms and other international bodies to cover up its daily crimes against Palestinians. In a statement, Iran's foreign ministry stressed the regime has always tried to use the victims of crimes in the Second World War to justify atrocities against Palestinians. The ministry said the regime has subjected Palestinians to all sorts of violations, especially crimes against humanity. It said that genocide, terror, and ethnic cleansing are just some of the crimes the regime is committing against Palestinians. The ministry further stressed Israel maintains the same racist and expansionist ideology that triggered the crimes committed during the Second World War.
Is the British Home Office abusing its powers by denying a former Guantanamo Bay detainee his citizenship rights? That is the accusation being made by Cage's outreach director Moazzam Beg, who announced he's taking legal action in the hope of winning back his passport.
I've been arrested under terrorism laws three times, and I've had my passport taken away three times, all without any due process, all without any access to legal recourse, and all by governments of Britain, both Labour and Conservative. And yet I have not been convicted of any crime. I've never had my day in court. And I have actually been declared innocent by the very police that arrested me in the first place.
Moazzam is a British human rights defender who was made famous when he was detained and tortured by the US in Afghanistan's notorious Bagram prison and Guantanamo Bay between 2002 to 2005. Ever since his return to the UK, Mr. Beg's passport has been seized three times in just 8 years, the latest being in September 2021.
I gave evidence at war crimes tribunals. I have given evidence to the International Criminal Court for Britain and America's role in torture and abuse there. And I've looked at Britain and America's role in the rendition program with countries they claim not to have good relations with. And that, I believe, has been one of the key reasons why I have been targeted.
Beg has been accused of support for extremist groups in the past over his aid and investigative work in war zones such as Syria and Afghanistan, but was always found to be innocent. The Home Office has yet to publicly comment on this latest passport matter. This battle will be very significant, especially given the fact that Number 10 is currently trying to gift itself new powers to essentially remove people's citizenship at will with the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill. Many critics fear that the government just simply can't be trusted to wield powers like this fairly. Robert Carter, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Wei. The U.S. confrontation with Russia continues unabated, and it appears not all European countries are in sync or in step with U.S. moves when it comes to the nuclear power nation. Germany has said that it will not supply Kiev with weapons for now, something which has drawn the anger from Ukraine. Is it because of Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine why Germany has taken a different approach than the warmonger U.S., and if this split is true among other European nations. We will also take a look at whether the U.S.'s ultimate goal is to destabilize Central Asian countries in order to prevent, as they see it, Russia's expansionist aspirations. All right, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Vladimir Goldstein. He's an associate professor of Slavic studies at Brown University, who joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Also joining us, Urs Unkopf, Government Relations Director at BWA, who joins us from Berlin.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you, gentlemen, and I'm going to start with you, Urs Unkopf, if I may. When it comes to Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine, what are we looking at when it comes to the U.S. position? It seems like it's pretty clear that it wants to provide arms to not only the Baltic states, if I'm correct to say that, and it also has NATO doing its military maneuvers, moving eastward and putting pressure on Russia. I mean, at this point, we're looking at the latest that we have of U.S. arms delivery, 90 tons of U.S. military aid, part of the $200 million, from what I'm reading here, of lethal aid, which is part of the $2.5 billion delivered so far. I can get into some of the details behind this. What are we looking at when it comes to this massive military injection when it comes, and it's emanating from the U.S. mainly here?
Good evening. Thank you for the question. So I think it is quite clear that the Biden administration and President Biden don't want to risk an immediate open war. This is why those discussions on arms delivery and all those preparatory measures are now pushed forward in the U.S. It is quite clear that Ukraine is not a NATO member, and in the Baltic states, there are totally different conditions, different frameworks applying. Let me also add from the German point of view, the recent days there has been widely discussed in the German media the statement of the now former head of the German Navy, which was definitely not helpful for the debate. I think at the moment and at this phase of the conflict where we have now arrived, it is the most important task of every politician to de-escalate in every way. That means de-escalation on the military as well as in the political level, and also important on the level of public discourse. The German Foreign Minister, Annalena Baerbock, has clearly stated during her recent visit to Moscow and during the meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, that Germany is not going to deliver arms into conflict zones, and that has also been confirmed towards the Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba. So it is quite clear that Germany will try to use its position to negotiate and to get all the relevant stakeholders, involved parties, back to the negotiation table, because this is the most important in this situation to prevent an open war.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you have that take on this, and I'm going to ask you, Vladimir Goldstein, our guest there from Berlin, says that it doesn't seem like there's going to be a war scenario that's going to pan out of this. I'm looking at deliveries of U.S.-made Stinger shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles to Kiev. I'm looking at the U.K. Let me go down the list, who has delivered a small number of anti-armor defensive weapon systems. I mean, if it smells like war, it looks like war, it looks like there's going to be a war. What do you think? Do you think that this is the scenario set for war or not?
Well, I think it's we all know in the real world things can happen. And potentially, of course, it can lead to the war. But I don't think there is interest in terms of the war neither on the Russian side, nor on the Ukrainian side, nor on the European side. Of course, you know, it's in the interest of the United States and probably, you know, England is somehow to create this appearance of danger, appearance of trouble, but they are definitely pursuing their own interests. There is interest of American military industrial complex. You know, they're very active. They like to sell their weapons. There are interests of some industry sector. They are not very much interested in Russia trading with, you know, Germany. They prefer Germany and other European countries dealing, you know, with the United States, gas companies and oil companies. So they pursue their own interests. But, you know, there are endless amount of reports, including BBC and many other people, that people neither in Russia nor in Kiev feel imminent war. They know that this is just, you know, saber rattling, talk, people pursuing their own political agendas. And, you know, this is a very good example of German Navy chief Schönbach, who said that this is all kind of, the war is not happening, and the idea with Crimea is over, let's move forward, let's have pragmatic discussion. However, he was immediately forced to retire. So in other words, the United States pushes this program, pursuing its military and economic interests, which lie not from the war, they benefit not from the war, but from fear-mongering, and warmongering and the stuff, and splitting Germany from Russia. That's another very important dimension.
Aha. So you saved the best for last. I appreciate that. Urs Unkopf, are we looking at that? Are we looking at the fact that you have, and you're in Berlin, that Germany is standing up, and as you said, they want to see if this can be worked out. They're taking the diplomatic approach. This is said to be a first major test for the Social Democrat Scholz. Also, that German politicians understand Russia, so to speak, and that understanding remains alive, which is why there's a push for this to be taken down a notch or two, or even more. But is it true what our guest there said? Is there also a push somehow for Germany to be separated from Russia? Because Germany obviously is a major player in this whole scheme when it comes to European countries.
That's a very interesting question, and I would agree with many of the points my colleague mentioned so far. Of course, there are interest groups which try to push Germany back from Russia into a one-sided position towards Ukraine, but first and overall, Germany needs to align its foreign policy with its national interests, and our national interests do neither 100% comply with the Russian position, nor 100% with the Ukrainian position. So that is also why the German business community, and so far also the politics during the era of Angela Merkel, has, for example, separated business relations from political relations. And it is also in our interest to develop good relations with Ukraine, but also on the same time to maintain those relations with Russia. Russia is one of the most important suppliers for oil and gas for Germany. Russia has fulfilled all its commitments in this sphere. And there have been various statements from different stakeholders that if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is technically ready to operate, also will be put into operation, it will not be a shutdown of a gas transit, natural gas transit through Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So all those questions needs to be discussed on a rational level. And once again, I would like to underline, we need to de-escalate and to put out the tension of this debate at the moment.
Sure. Well, you had one courageous Navy chief from Germany, Vladimir Goldstein, to stand up. He said it was nonsense to think that Russia was about to invade Ukraine, and that also praising, in a sense, the Russian President Vladimir Putin, said that he deserves respect, and then he went on to resign. This, the fact that he says it's nonsense, goes flat against what the U.S. stance is, and of course, the U.S. has pulled other countries to believe that Russia is going to invade. Is it nonsense, Russian invasion theory?
Yeah, I think it is nonsense. And, you know, the problem is that professionals, be it, you know, real academics, real military people, you know, Navy, German Navy have the intelligence sources. They know that very well. they can sense the mood in Ukraine, in Russia. There is no mood for war. So he just says something which kind of makes sense and based on reality. However, what I would want to stress is the amount of propaganda which one sees in British TV, in American TV, is mind-staggering. I left Russia and the Soviet Union in the 70s, and even then it wasn't such unified voice condemning this, pronouncing this, making all this kind of unified. God forbid that there is some dissent note. The same thing is just now orchestrated by United States propaganda. So somebody who makes sense out of the blue declared a pariah and told to resign. But sooner or later, you know, there is what is important, that Germany is an economic powerhouse. They have their interests. They have their traditions. You know, Russia and Germany, of course, they were in the wars, but they were trading, they were partners. There's endless amount of cultural, political, philosophical exchanges. So these two countries are more or less have to trade with each other and have to function. And they are located very close to each other in Europe. So why not United States and England, which is also very far from the Central Europe, interfere and play their geopolitical games at the expense, I want to underline, at the expense, not Ukraine. Ukraine can find their way negotiating, de-escalating, my colleague said, and Ukraine can function too. But they should promote American interest in the heart of Europe, because for the time being, that's what Ukraine is doing.
Well, maybe it's a good time for us to try to summarize very briefly, if you can, Urs Unkov, why it is that Russia has been demonized by the U.S., not only demonized, but also cited as a national security threat. We can go back to when they said that they meddled in the U.S. elections, but of course Ukraine was the tipping point. Why do you think that Russia is on the target of the U.S. or the radar of the U.S. to such extreme?
Well, of course, it's a geopolitical competition where we see at the moment mainly three players, the U.S., China, and Russia. And also interesting is the second part of the statement of this former German Navy chief. He mentioned that we should align stronger with Russia in order to contain China. And we have to understand that it is not in our interest as a power in the center of Europe, as one of Europe's strongest players, as Germany, to play Russia against China. Nor is it not in our interest to play the U.S. against Russia. And I hope that Germany, in the course of this year, will reset multilateral dialogue formats. Germany currently holds the presidency of the G7, which also could make a step towards Russia, towards retaking the dialogue. But at the moment, I see that we need to put out the tension of the public discourse to avoid a situation like we had before the First World War. Before the First World War started, every media, every newspaper was writing about the war and the possibility of war. And if we just talk about war and not how to avoid the war, then the war in the end will come. And this needs to be prevented with all possible forces from all stakeholders.
Well, there needs to be a reminder here, which many may seem to have forgotten because it's going back to such a long time ago, Vladimir Goldstein, and that is the fact that Ukraine has mainly not been fighting Russian armed forces in the Donbas region. People don't seem to really realize that. And you know, Russia may have trained or may have armed them, but they're not doing the fighting. Russia's military involvement might be more so, if anything, on the advisory part of this, which led to the separation. I mean, isn't that something that needs to be highlighted so people who are involved in this, any of the players, realize, you know, this is not Russian direct involvement?
That's absolutely the case. You know, what we know from the very recent history is, you know, Eastern Ukraine, Donbas region, were rather sympathetic to Kyiv until 2014, when, you know, they were demonized, they were immediately called separatists, traitors, blah, 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 and now recent polls conducted by Kyiv suggest that, you know, people in Donbass don't want to be part of Kyiv regime. So what we have a very serious civil tension. So people in Donbass are Russian speakers. They are Russian, culturally, while Kyiv want to subjugate them not give them autonomy, not allow them to be their own choice. They want to subjugate them. They bombard them. They kill civilians. So far, 14,000 people were killed on all sides, but a lot of civilians. So it plays very bad in Russia, you know, because Russians feel that this is their Russian brothers. Furthermore, quite, you know, during recent times, many of the people in this Donbass region got their Russian passport. So they're technically Russians too. This is, of course, this is a complicated geopolitical game the countries play. But, you know, you have to be aware that Russia have to protect these people on eastern Donbass. So what's important is for everyone to sit at the table and discuss. But what we see that Ukraine prefers to hide that too. They prefer to talk and blame Russians. They prefer to get American aid. They prefer to play British aid. They prefer to claim victims while, you know, they haven't solved even, you know, situation in their own territory. They didn't solve it yet. So, you know, why on earth this country, which cannot solve, you know, their own problems, dictate Germany, mm-hmm. you know, United States, Russia, Canada, what to do? It's a really big unanswered question.
There was an interesting statement that came from the U.S. President, Usunkov, just days ago, and I'd like to find out from you what you thought of it, even though he retracted that statement, and he said that a small-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine might not lead NATO to respond with full force the way that he was describing it. And that really ticked off Ukraine, and it took many by surprise. Again, scrambled to take back that statement. But do you think that that is something that the U.S. Actually means, that it's okay if it even turns out to be that way, that a small-scale incursion by Russia is something that the U.S. or NATO would tolerate?
Well, I think this statement once again shows how tense the situation is, but realistically, I think that U.S. would risk a war, which would be, in every case, a nuclear war with Russia about Ukraine. It's more about to underline how the frontiers are at the moment, and I think that it is quite obvious that Putin is a strategist and he knows quite well how far he can go. The same applies for the Biden administration. So there needs just to be defined where their faces, where both could agree on a certain format of negotiations. It might be the Minsk group, but we should also be open for new formats to find a constructive solution.
All right, let's look at this from a vantage point that's not just about war and the possibility of it. Vladimir Goldstein, we know what had happened in Ukraine. The U.S. pretty much came out and said it was involved in the color revolution. They like colors. There was a revolution there. I think it was called purple for that color. I forget. Maybe you can tell us. So based on that, what color was it?
Orange,
I'm sorry. Okay, so you have that execution by the U.S., which stirred up the country, and some are suggesting, some analysts, that that's what the U.S. is actually after, Central Europe and the European countries that maybe were in the sphere of Russia, to create some kind of instability, Kyrgyzstan being the latest example, and this would then be a bulwark against Russia to prevent Russia from wanting to expand in their eyes. Do you think that that is the case?
Yeah, that's the case. You know, what we have to remember that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia was a kind of very weak and very weak on the international space. So United States believed that they can sort of call all the shots. So they, you know, play their games with Europe. They expanded NATO. And, you know, it worked very well in their favor, and they want to continue this way. So obviously when Russia becomes more self-assertive, it's already kind of a threat. So they are, you know, using that. But also in terms of geopolitics, we do have to remember that Europe is Europe. And this is very, you know, if we have EU and Russia, and, you know, after all, China wants to trade there. If this is a very powerful bloc, trading together, working together economically, then United States is actually an odd man out. They can be somewhere trading with Latin America, but they'll be kicked out of Europe because they're not placed there. They're geographically, they're not located. So they don't want to accept it. They want to stay in Europe. So I think this, you know, there's certain Eastern European countries like Poland, Baltics, and Ukraine, are their foothold, and they will do everything to protect it, which, you know, works, A, they preserve American interests, and B, due to geographical location of Ukraine, it is precisely the place, you know, Ukraine and Poland, they separate Russia and Germany from, you know, getting a very, you know, a consistent economic relationship, which has, you know, been all the time. If you look at the history, you just mentioned First World War. One of the ideas, you know, there were negotiations between Russia and Germany. They wanted to work together, but for England, it was absolute sort of taboo. So they did all they could to set up Russia against Germany, and I think that's a pretty successful strategy of Anglo, you know, sphere to somehow to keep these two countries very separate from each other because it's in their interest.
All right, so since we're drawing down with the time here, Urs Unkov, you know, it should all come down to the economy, and I'm looking at the point of view of Germany, looking at the situation, and even other European countries. If they're going to be pressured by the U.S., I'm sure the question comes about, so what will we gain by going against Russia? Is the U.S. pressuring these countries with economic incentives to go against Russia? Even though Russia, as I'm sure you're well aware, not only is a very big supplier of a variety of goods for Germany, perhaps, but in the bigger picture for Europe and the European Union. So how can the U.S. pressure these countries to go against Russia?
We had such a situation already when some senators from the Republicans announced that they would sanction all companies directly or indirectly working on the Nord Stream 2 project, but the German economy in general has a strong commitment in Russia as well as in Ukraine, and also our association has a reliable partner in both countries, so the German economy needs to define its own interests, and that can only be that we can continue with stable and good businesses in this region. Russia is a very important traditional partner since the 1970s. Russia delivers a significant share of Germany's energy consumption. Mm-hmm. However, there has been a common European effort in Ukraine within the last years, especially in regional developments, and also those efforts should not be taken off. So I think in a mid to long term perspective, also economic relations could help to build new bridges when politics fail to find a common ground of speech. The economy can build new bridges.
Well, that's a hope there. And to round this off, Vladimir Goldstein, when you have the U.S., as our guest there just mentioned, and I think this happened not too recently, but it was very recent, Republican lawmakers in the U.S. saying that threatening Germany with sanctions if they were to, you know, have companies work on the Nord Stream 2. In essence, they're saying, let your customers pay double, triple the price for gas, but no, you shouldn't work on the project. So how does the U.S. look when it exerts that type of pressure on Germany?
Well, U.S. doesn't look, you know, very good. And I think what we have to be aware that, you know, Merkel was a very experienced politician with, you know, very stable relationship with the United States. And she probably could push things back, you know, when, you know, crazy American senators trying to gain some popularity at home would pronounce some idiotic propositions like, you know, extra sanctions. She could push back. I think now United States want to try this new leadership of Germany and see how kind of, you know, how resistant they will be. But, you know, there's nothing wrong in United States trying. You know, that's their interest. They are more than happy to promote their own sort of companies. Yeah. They are more than happy to let Ukraine still be, you know, in the center of gas transportation. So Ukraine, by the way, somebody calculated 18% of their economy depends on the money they get from this old pipeline, so they did. So that's where Americans will be pushing, and I think it's up to Europeans to resist it and, you know, convince Americans that we everybody has their own interest. Not the world is not reduced to Washington and American interest.
Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Vladimir Goldstein, many thanks for your contribution. Associate Professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University from Providence, Rhode Island, and Urs Unkov. Thank you. Government Relations Director at BWA from Berlin. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikovit Tarve, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is my flask. Some dates. A warm jacket. It might be colder. And this is my woolen hat. You know, I'm a type of person who is sensitive to cold. Now, let me zip up the backpack. Done. Well, you might be curious to know where I'm going to visit today, yeah? Actually, it's not a far-off place. Today, I'm going to visit a part of the beautiful nature of Tehran. Yes, Sorkhe Hesar Park. I promise it would be a brief but enjoyable visit. Stay with me. Sorkhe Hesar is one of the national parks of Iran, which is located east of Tehran, with an area of about 9,168 hectares. Except its northeastern part, all parts of this district is under the protection of the Environment Organization. The National Park of Sorkhe Hesar is one of the oldest protected zones of the world and dates back to the Qajarid era. In the past, Sorkhe Hesar used to be one of the oldest hunting areas of Iran and enjoyed a special status. It was during the rule of Aga Muhammad Khan Qajar that Jajrud region was chosen as a hunting place, and during the rule of Fath Ali Shah Qajar, the entire regions of Jajrud and Sorkhe Hesar were recognized as hunting places. This park was registered as a national park in 1980. The weather in Sorkhe Hesar is half dry, and the difference of temperature between day and night is high. Jajrud River flows in this region, and after passing through the Latian Dam, flows in the marginal parts of the region, and then spills into Parchin Township and leaves off. This park is created from meadows, hills, and heights, which are as high as 1,220 to 2,147 meters. I am now at Sorkhe Hesar Park. What a clean air! In front of me, just far away from me, those hills are blanketed with snow. However, in this part which I'm standing, there is no snow, but it's so cold. I'd better wear my gloves. Sorkha Hisar Park has diverse flora. There are different types of trees, bushes, shrubs, and herbs in this park. Some of these herbs have medicinal effects. And there are also rare types of herbs in this region, which are unfortunately on the verge of becoming extinct. Tell you an interesting fact. Sorkha Hisar has two types of flora. One type, which has plants of hot regions, including tamarisk, milkwetch, and wild rue. And the other type, which has step-like plants, including thymes, zizifora, and pennyroyal. Though, there is no trace of these herbs here because of the cold. If it wasn't a cold season, I would pick some zizifora for my grandma. She loves it in her tea. Oh, the sound of these birds is very beautiful. I can recognize some of these sounds. Though, there are many types of birds here. There is heron, hawk, bitterns, even vulture in here. Sorkha Hisar has also a diverse fauna and is indeed the treasury of Iran's environment. Well, Sorkha Hisar, beside its great nature, has many facilities to entertain you. Here, there is a cycling route. Good job! And also, there is a road for those who like to hike in the nature. On my right, there is a sports complex which has facilities for sports like tennis, paintball, billiards, darts, and shooting. And here, there is also a theme park for children. In this park, children can have fun and at the same time, get educated about the culture of traffic. And there is a pergola here, which sells tea and coffee. Drinking a cup of Iranian tea in this weather really hits the spot. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.